first of all, I want to thank Eugene for that wonderful introduction, and I want to thank the Philadelphia Society for inviting me to participate. You'll probably be interested to know that at lunchtime, Lino told me that as a result of my op-ed piece coming out tomorrow in which I proposed that he be made a recess appointee to the Court of Appeals, he took out four additional insults to me from his prepared remarks. So to that, I thank you, Lino. Lino and I go way back. Nobody is more fun to joust with than he is. I actually wanted to depart from what I had originally intended on talking about to respond a little bit to the opening panel of this conference on the rule of law, because although I had planned on talking about, as beginning my remarks, by talking about what I think the rule of law is in order to apply it to the problem of terrorism, I actually, though I did disagree with everything that Lino said from the floor this morning, I also disagreed with some of what the panelists said about natural law and natural rights. As Lino knows, and as many of you know, I'm a strong proponent of natural rights, and in my book, The Structure of Liberty, I lay out what I consider to be a defense, a comprehensive defense of the idea of natural rights and its importance, the importance of natural rights. But there is a subtitle of my book. The subtitle of my book is Justice and the Rule of Law, because in the book I try to explain the relationship between justice, which I believe is defined by natural rights, and the rule of law, which is actually something different. And I guess where I took issue with the emphasis of the panel this morning was in conflating natural rights or natural law and justice on the one hand with the rule of law on the other hand, because I consider these two things to be actually different from each other. And it's important to keep them separated in our minds in order to apply this concept of the rule of law, for example, to the problem of how do we fight terrorism. What is the relationship then between justice and the rule of law? Justice, as defined by natural rights, is a very useful concept in evaluating the legitimacy of law to see whether law has strayed too far from the mandate of the lawmaker in order to actually constitute an unjust interference with the liberty of individuals. But the problem with natural rights as a means of constraining or evaluating laws, or constraining and evaluating the behavior of government, is that the way that we derive natural rights is by abstracting from the particulars of our individual circumstances to certain generalities, and from these generalities we make certain general conclusions about the nature of the fundamental rights of human beings, such as the rights to life, liberty, and property. The problem with these generalizations, however, is that they're general, and they don't apply themselves automatically and deductively to individual particular cases and controversies that come before us either inside the legal system or as citizens evaluating our legal system. They are just too abstract for that purpose. In order to know what justice requires of each one of us, we require, therefore, a rule of law which specifies both the conduct that we are supposed to be doing and the conduct that the lawmakers are supposed to be doing. We need, in other words, conventional rules of law to put into effect these abstract principles of justice, in part to solve the problem of knowledge, which is knowing what these abstract requirements of justice really require of us. So the rules of law, and what are these rules of law? I'm talking about formal general statements made in advance of you being punished or being prosecuted or being sued that put you on notice as to what is or is not permitted into a particular legal system. And there's lots of different kinds of rules of law that are equally compatible with these abstract conceptions of justice, which is why just knowing what our abstract rights are does not automatically tell us what rules of law we ought to have. These rules of law are conventional and must be determined, in Aquinas' words. They are not deducible from the abstract natural law or natural rights. So we have to have these rules of law. And one of the purposes of the rules of law I've just given you, and that is so that we, as individual citizens, know what is required of us when the abstract principles of justice are just too vague to tell us. But there is another function, a very important function, that's performed by these conventional rules, these statements of rules of law in advance, and that is as a constraint on the exercise of power. Because what we do when we constitute a government in order to protect our liberties, is we give these individuals, who we call a government, they're just nothing more than human beings like we are, we give these individuals powers that we normally don't exercise for ourselves. We delegate to them the executive power that is belongs to us in the state of nature, but which in a civil society we feel it's safer to delegate to these individuals in order to better protect our individual liberties. But in so doing, we empower these people not only to do the right thing, but we also give them powers that can be abused. And one of the very important functions of the rule of law is to protect us against these abuses. Now, how is that done? One way that it's done is simply by specifying in advance what the scope of these powers are in devices such as, for example, a written constitution. We're able to evaluate whether a particular action by government is within or without the powers that have been delegated to it. But another function is simply to warn us when a particular government official may have overstepped the appropriate bounds in ways that are very difficult for outsiders to detect. They're even difficult for insiders to detect. In order to illustrate that, let me tell you a little story from my days as a Cook County state's attorney. And here we are going to talk about corruption in the Circuit Court of Cook County. One of my tasks as a prosecutor was to be assigned to auto theft court in Cook County, which handled all auto thefts in the city. And this, the judge that presided over this court was named, I didn't make this up, Judge Devine. So Judge Devine, who had recently been assigned to this court, we had no idea anything about this judge. We should have known, actually, because it turns out he was transferred from traffic court, where his nickname, unbeknownst to us in the prosecutor's office, was Dollars Devine. That should have been a tip-off as to what was going on here. But we didn't know this, and so we put on a preliminary hearing on a very big case. It was a chop shop case, which is a case involving organized crime, chopping up cars and selling the parts. It's the most egregious form of auto theft that you can have. And we put on this case in front of Judge Devine. And normally Judge Devine was a pretty, what we used to call, pro-state judge, pro-prosecution judge. He would rule for us, and so we kind of liked him. But in this particular case, in most of these preliminary hearings, in all these preliminary hearings, Judge Devine had a very narrow scope that he attached to the relevance of certain evidence. For example, he said constitutional objections to the search were beyond the scope of a preliminary hearing, and therefore, in each and every case where defense attorneys try to raise the issues involving a constitutionality of the search, he would say no. He would sustain our objections and say no, that's beyond the scope of a preliminary hearing. Well, we put on this case. It was a big case. It had a kind of high-priced lawyer in front of him. And the high-priced lawyer starts asking our police witness about the constitution, the circumstances surrounding the arrest, and whether the search had been constitutional. And we objected, as we always did, and the objection was overruled. This had never happened before. Now, a lot of judges would let this kind of evidence in, but Judge Devine had a rule against this. But he let this evidence in, and we kept objecting. He kept overruling our objection, and what the police officer began testifying to was the circumstances that defined an illegal search. So now you had a police officer being cross-examined by the defense attorney who was now testifying that the search was illegal, testifying that they did not have probable cause, testifying that it was a defective search. That resulted in Judge Devine dismissing the case. Now, had this happened in front of a judge who had a different rule of law governing the use of evidence in his case, we simply might have chalked this up to a corrupt police officer, because it's not typical, by the way, for police officers to freely testify about how the circumstances of their searches were illegal. But we knew more as a result of the way this went down. We knew, for example, that Judge Devine had to be in on it. And the way we knew that he had to be in on it is because he, in order to reach this result, had to deviate from the pre-existing rule of law that existed in his court. And so in this case, we're just talking about a rule of evidence that could be something other than what it is. There's nothing written in the stars. There's nothing written in natural rights about the scope of a preliminary hearing. But the mere fact that there was a pre-existing rule of law that had to be violated provided us with absolutely critical information. Not in this case, because in this case we lost. But it provided us with critical information for the future. And the future took two forms. One is we were able to avoid Judge Devine where possible by going to the grand jury on any of these big cases that were likely to be, where he was likely to be receiving payoffs from the mob indirectly through this mob lawyer. And secondly, and unbeknownst to me, my junior partner in this case, who was in this courtroom, went on about a year later to be an undercover officer in the federal investigation of the state of the corruption in the Circuit Court of Cook County, and he became an undercover agent, I should say, for the FBI, in which he fingered to the federal authorities all the corrupt people that we had discovered were corrupt in the course of him being a prosecutor. And as a result, Judge Define was arrested and prosecuted for corruption, not for our case, but for a variety of other cases. I actually got the satisfaction of attending his trial, in which I watched him being prosecuted, and he was convicted, and he went to the penitentiary for corruption, where he eventually died while in custody in the penitentiary. But the point of the story is that we couldn't have prosecuted Judge Define for corruption if we hadn't known he was corrupt, and we wouldn't have known he was corrupt if he hadn't violated the rule of law in order to reach a corrupt result. And for that reason, the rule of law served its purpose. So the rule of law not only serves its purpose in constraining it. I mean, Judge Define, there was a rule of law that said Judge Define was not supposed to do what he did. But the rule of law also served its purpose by informing us, giving us vital information that Judge Define was acting improperly, and that allowed us to take other measures in order to eventually do justice to him. That is the function of the rule of law, among other things, and that is what we must keep in mind in evaluating the behavior of the federal government in pursuing terrorism. Now, let me just say, I generally support what the Bush administration has done in pursuing the war on terrorism. I am not a big critic of the Bush administration here. I definitely support what the Bush administration has done in the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan. But I do think that the Bush administration has exceeded, in some respects, the rule of law in pursuit of these ends. I also, by the way, I meant to say this. I'm not sure I agree with Lino about the fact that what they've done has been inadequate. I think what the Bush administration done, judging by the result, has been pretty darn good. In the aftermath of 9/11, nobody would have thought we'd go a year and a half without another major terrorist incident against the United States. And so what the Bush administration actually did, which it does involve, I think, in large measure, routing up illegal immigrants, and either deporting them or incarcerating them for a period of time. What the Bush administration did, whatever they did, seems to have worked. If you're going to judge by the results have been extremely positive and I think deserve support as a result of the positive results. But I just want to focus now on a couple of exceptions where I think that the administration has gone too far. One of them I'll spend more time on. I was planning on talking about two. I'll tell you the two I was going to talk about. One is the treatment of unlawful combatants who are American citizens. And the second one has to do with aspects of the USA Patriot Act, some of which I think is a very good idea, and there's a few things in the USA Patriot Act that I think are quite disturbing. Let me just talk about the treatment of unlawful combatants. And I'll talk about a different guy who's under arrest. Rather than Massawi, I'll talk about Jose Padilla. Jose Padilla is an American citizen who was arrested in the United States after coming into this country allegedly with a plan or part of a conspiracy to commit an act of terrorism in the United States. He was not in possession, so far as we know, of any particular written plans or any particular devices that were used, but he was part of a conspiracy when he came into this country. Fine. I have absolutely no objection, as a former prosecutor or as a citizen of the United States, to Jose Padilla being arrested for this. But what's happened to Jose Padilla? Jose Padilla has been detained as an unlawful combatant. He's been detained under direct orders from the President of the United States. That's it. He has not been detained pursuant to any law, and he has not been detained pursuant to any express power granted to the President of the United States to detain him other than the President's war-making power and the ability of the President to designate a particular individual as an unlawful combatant. And, moreover, had Jose Padilla been not an American citizen, he would have been subject to the administration's military tribunal's order, in which case he might have received a military tribunal to adjudicate whether he was or is not, in fact, guilty of having been part of a conspiracy to commit a terrorist act in the United States. But because he is a United States citizen, he is exempt. In fact, the executive order that defines military tribunals does not apply to American citizens. So as a result, he has received no hearing whatsoever. He is simply detained indefinitely at the will of the President of the United States. Now, I am reasonably confident, I really don't know, but I'm willing to believe that he's guilty. I'm willing to believe that they got the right guy. But I don't think that simply is enough to satisfy us. Let me suggest to you that if the Clinton administration had been guilty of doing this sort of thing, many people in this room would have been a lot more concerned about it than the fact that it was the Bush administration who did it. Now, that may be because you trust the Bush administration more than you trust the Clinton administration, and that's actually a rational response. But I don't believe that. The one thing that the rule of law tells us is that it shouldn't, the merits or demerits of a particular government action should not turn necessarily on the who happens to be in charge, who happens to be holding an office at a particular time. It should be turning, we should have a system in which even when Janet Reno is Attorney General, or even when we have a Democratic president, that these particular civil liberties are, our particular civil liberties are going to be protected, or they are not going to exceed the boundaries of what is proper. So I think we should be concerned about this. Now, I think that this particular, but what is it that we should be concerned about? Let me get specific. I mean, it's one thing just to tell this story, but I think this story is illustrative of a problem that we haven't seen very much of. So I don't think this is something, I don't think the sky is falling. I don't think that the administration is running rampant through the streets, which is what the left would want to tell you about them. But it is an example of something that I think is a step too far, and I think what unfortunately would set a does in fact set a very dangerous precedent for the future. And the rule of law does tend to include the doctrine of precedent that like cases should be treated alike. And this is what the problem is. First of all, that the president did it entirely on his own authority, and that this authority does not come either from the Constitution directly or from an act of Congress. And I think that's a serious problem. Secondly, that Jose Padilla has not been given any sort of hearing whatsoever, not even a military tribunal. I think that's a problem. And I think it's a very dangerous precedent. And thirdly, let's just let it go with that. So this is a serious problem. And what is the source of the problem? And why does it relate to the rule of law? Because what the president has done here is not subject to any. Now, I think there actually were a lot of good things, there are a lot of productive, useful things in the USA Patriot Act to change current law in order to address terrorism. But there are certain things that are problematic about the way this bill was passed. First of all, when this terrorism legislation was under consideration, the House Judiciary Committee was actually working through a compromise between House members, Republicans and Democrats, in order to balance civil liberties against the need to protect security. But all of their efforts were simply thwarted when the administration and the House leadership pulled their bill and substituted for it the administration bill, which was then put to a vote without any independent scrutiny by the House whatsoever. And in this bill was basically a wish list of every Justice Department request to Congress, that including some that had been denied in the past, that had come from the Clinton administration in particular, and it was all simply passed. Some of these provisions were good. Let me just tell you about one that I think is problematic. The one that's problematic is the fact that this bill allowed the federal government to basically, if individual members of law enforcement agencies in the federal government, to scrutinize where you web browse without having to make any showing of any major kind to any outside agency, including a judge. They're allowed to, under the terms of the statute, to go to a court and say and simply affirm that this search that they want to do, this surveillance they want to do of your web browsing activities, would be relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. And by the way, not an ongoing criminal investigation confined to terrorism. Would be to any ongoing criminal investigation. Now, what's wrong with this, judging by the rule of law? What's wrong with this, according to the rule of law, is that it gives complete and total discretion. Is there somebody started trying to sell me something here? The Philadelphia Society can't handle the truth. This is the. Thank you. The problem here is it gives complete and total discretion to the executive branch to decide who they're going to survey and who they aren't. Now, as long as they're looking for the right people at the right time, we don't have any substantive objection. But the principle of giving the federal government the opportunity to examine at their own discretion, without any outside review, whether they're what your web browsing activities are, what websites you go to, what you visit, what you look at, is simply not necessary to deal with the problem of terrorism. What would I propose as an alternative to that? Simply the traditional requirements of the Constitution, that in order to have that sort of eavesdropping activity in this new form, as opposed to the eavesdropping activities we've had in the past, that the federal government have to obtain a warrant in order to, after a showing of probable cause, to think that you are involved in an illegal act. And under the act, that expands the kinds of illegal acts to include terrorist activities. Now, that is the sort of procedural requirement the Constitution requires elsewhere. It's a perfectly sensible one, and it's also one, I should tell you, as a former prosecutor who evaluated warrants, that's not that terribly difficult for the government to satisfy when, in fact, they have a legitimate reason to do so. I would like to believe that every use of the USA Patriot Act power that the government currently is using could satisfy that warrant requirement. I believe it could. But I think, nevertheless, notwithstanding the fact that perhaps the Bush administration hasn't done anything wrong yet with respect to this additional power that has been given under the USA Patriot Act, does not make me feel that much better when we should, in fact, have a particular they should be subjected to a requirement that in the future they show that a particular individual has been involved. There's probable cause to believe that a particular individual has been involved in a criminal activity, including prospective acts of terrorism. Let me close now by remarking on a reaction that existed to the 9/11 outrage. I think almost on the same day as the 9/11, as when 9/11 happened. And that was the reaction immediately in the press, and that is the reaction that we're going to have to sacrifice liberty for security. And then that was done in terms of asking all the experts on television, are we going to have to sacrifice liberty for security? And then there was all this polling done about, are we going to have to sacrifice liberty for security? This was done on the very day this happened. It was certainly done within the next week that it happened. And here's my objection to that. Why do we ask this question in the abstract? How can we even answer that question in the abstract? There is no answer to that question in the abstract. What we should be asking is a particular measure necessary in order to, that might restrict liberty, necessary to protect security? You don't want to advocate, you don't want to have a blank check. Of course you have to sacrifice liberty for security. We always have to ask whether a particular measure is necessary, but that is not the way the question was being framed. It was being framed in general. And framing the question in general that way, I submit, is something that's done by people who are really not all that concerned with individual liberty. And this is now a justification for restricting liberty rather than a justification for fighting terrorism, which is what I would support. And I believe, for example, many of the provisions in the USA Patriot Act actually do. So with that, I will leave you, and thank you for your attention.